Jeremy Hall, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag SDRask podcast. And with me today, as always, almost always, is Greg Kokel. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Amy, have we had in the past other of our kind of young guns on the show? I'm trying to remember.
Yes, when you've been gone, they've filled in for you on occasion.
Alan or Tim or John or somebody, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, a lot this year.
That's right.
They filled in for me a lot this year.
Oh, that's right. Well, that was right. They were on your side, not mine, because of... Okay.
So let us start with a question from Alice. And Alice asks, if a husband believes that hell is temporary, annihilationism, is the wife obligated to teach her kids that doctrine because the man is a spiritual leader and she has to submit to his authority? She has a second part after your answer. So
yeah, this is an interesting question. I mean, my impulse is to say no. I mean, it's because the authority does not the authority that a husband has over his wife does not involve the authority to communicate falsehood. You know, remember that a woman is to submit to a husband as unto Christ. Okay, so as if he were Christ, but the things that she's to submit to are only, in my view at least, only those things that are consistent with Christ. Now, it does raise a question of how to navigate in a circumstance like this. Maybe you have a different opinion about this, so I'm just going to offer this out, and then you could, you know, correct me if I need it. I think that the simple answer is no. She is not obligated to teach her children what she views to be a false doctrine. Okay, but she is obligated to continue to maintain herself even amidst this difference in a respectful, submissive way. Now, I know, well, people don't like that word anymore. You know, it's just, well, I'm sorry. This is the word that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 5, among other places. And what he says is submit. And he says it to a number of different groups of people, but this one certainly applies a wife to a husband. And the submission amounts to respecting the leadership of her husband. That comes a little bit later in the same passage, okay? So if the wife cannot in good conscience communicate that teaching to the kids, I think she could say so. I can't teach that to the children. I think it's false. And by the way, I think sometimes you just have a little difference of opinion, okay? And it's just no big deal, and there are just variations. There are a lot of those in Christianity. But some of them are more substantive, and I think this is a substantive one, a distinction. And in fact, Tim Barnett and I wrote a three-piece solid ground, or a three-part solid ground on this issue called Hell Interrupted. And people can go and see that. We addressed it because we thought this was a significant problem that was influencing the church. And so we gave our reasons, rationale, and argued against conditional immortality or annihilationism. then the question is, no, she's not obliged to teach them that. But then what does she do? And I think this would be appropriate to work this out, this kind of dance out with the husband, and say, and she could say maybe something, you know, honey, I disagree with you on that particular point. Okay, I'm not going to make a big fuss about it. You know, I'm not going to, but I can't in good conscience either accept something from the Bible that I think is false, or teach the falsehood to my children. Okay. So what I would like to do is to say, this is an area that Papa, Dad, and sorry, Dad and I disagree on. Okay. My kids used to call me Papa when they're younger. Now they call me Dad, which I like Papa myself, but in any event, this is an area where Dad and I disagree on. And this is his view, this is mine, but we're not going to make a fuss about it. And kind of move forward like that. So the kids See, well, there are differences, and the differences don't have to cause a division, okay? I think if the wife, on this particular issue, vigorously opposed her husband in the home with the children, I think this would be a problem in terms of the leadership dynamic. It might be that there are other features that are involved, other factors that are other doctrines that might be involved, where I would give different counsel, something even more weighty than this. But these are things that we have to hold in tension. You know, even when we disobey our government, we have to disobey our government if we're justified in doing that. Biblically, we have to do it in a way that shows respect for the institution that God has given authority to. So it isn't like the government's role is nullified if they have an unjust law that we are commanded to participate in. It just means that we do not participate in the unjust law, but however, we still show respect to the government in other regards. This is one of those kinds of, wow, this is a harder question. There's not, I think there is a right answer, obviously, about this, and I offered the one I think is correct, but there it is nuanced in the way that it is carried out, and because we have to take into consideration the other obligation that is here, and that is respecting the spiritual leadership of the husband or the father in the household. I don't know. That's the best I can do on this for now. Amy, I'm curious what you have to say about it.
Yeah, I agree with you, Greg. I think that the idea of maintaining your respect for your husband as you're talking to them, I think that's totally doable. And I think it's a healthy thing for them to see that, oh, we disagree on this, and he thinks this, and I think that. If you give the an appropriate representation of his views to them as well as yours, and everybody's respectful of the other view, I don't think that should be a problem for the kids or for the husband or anything. And I think it's kind of nice to see people disagree and do it charitably. Mm-hmm. And to see that you can still respect him and his leadership, even if you disagree. Mm-hmm. Now, the second part of her question, though.
Okay, before we get to that, let me just think. There was one other thing I wanted to say about this. In the disagreement in this particular case, I think, you know, if you can broker this with both parties, it'd be best to clarify the difference between the views, but not to argue for them. On this particular point, I don't think you need to argue for them. These are kids. They're not into the deep things of God yet. You know, you don't have to cross every T, dot every I, and these kinds of things. And if one argues, okay, we differ on this, and here's the reasons that I think Dad is wrong, and here's the reasons why Dad thinks I'm wrong, and then Dad can say that, whatever. Now you've got an adversarial circumstance, and it's almost as if the children have to choose between Dad's view and Mom's view. And when they're kids, I don't think that's a good thing for them to do. So I think it's just enough to say, here's what Mom thinks, here's what Dad thinks, and just leave it at that. And the kids can figure things out later for themselves when they're able to think more deeply about these issues.
And you can certainly emphasize the things you agree on. Mm-hmm. There will be a judgment.
Yeah. And it ain't going to be fun.
Yeah. So that's another thing. But besides just clarifying, you can also say, but the point is, mm-hmm, of Revelation is that,
ouch,
Jesus is coming back and there will be a judgment. And if you trust in him, we'll all go to be with him. So the second part of a question, I think you've answered this somewhat, but she says, if your answer would be that she would be free to tell the kids that she and the dad disagree and give her reasons for her view, what if her husband doesn't want her to do that? And I think your option of just saying, let's just say what our view is, but maybe not argue for it,
yeah,
I think that responds to that. But also, I would say, if he's asking you to teach something you disagree with, then I would take him to Romans 14 and talk about how we are not supposed to do things that go against our conscience and how we're not supposed to do something unless we can do it to the glory of God. So for him to compel you to teach something you disagree with, I think is wrong. Mm-hmm. And so it would be better to avoid the whole situation altogether and just talk about the judgment of God that will be coming without going into any details.
Mm-hmm. Now, it may be that he's not cooperative at this point, and he is not going to just say we disagree, but he's going to want to teach this alternate view. And I think at that point, it's best just to let it go. Just to let it go. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's not something that places someone outside of the pale. There are plenty of evangelicals who believe in conditional immortality. Are they? Am I getting my terms right here? Now I'm trying to remember. Is conditional immortality the annihilationist view? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Just checking. So there's. It's not outside of the pale to hold annihilationism. I mean, I don't think it is. I think you can still be a genuine Christian and be mistaken about this. On either side of the spectrum, everybody seems to acknowledge that for the most part. So it's not a matter of salvation, but it is a very important doctrine, as Tim and I emphasize in the piece Hell Interrupted. But it's still, like I said, not outside of the pale. So I don't think you should push it further and create division and harm inside the family on this.
But I think if it's possible to say your view respectfully, I think that's probably the best option. But, you know, I guess you'd have to work that out with your
spouse. Think that particular point is up to the husband. That would be my take. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm married, so I know that these things are not always easy to navigate and to negotiate. All right, just saying. So in an ideal world, the recommendations that Amy and I just offered would be adequate. Oh, let's be nice. We'll agree to disagree. Oh, yeah, it's okay. You give your side. I'll give my side. It doesn't always, okay, so we're fallen people in a fallen world. But these are the guidelines, I think, that should guide us. And we do our best in that. And we seek to be charitable. And we ask, God's grace covers us in the midst of this, both to help us and to forgive us in our shortcomings and as we try to pursue this. These things are not easy. And let me just add this, okay? I think it's complicated by the ethos of our society. This is why a moment ago I'm apologizing kind of for using the word submit. I mean, I wasn't really apologizing, but I had to say something about it because this bugs women so much because for the last 50 years, especially publicly, they've been told that this is anathema. And yet this is the teaching of the scriptures. And actually, it's not just in Ephesians 5. It's in Titus chapter 3. It's in 1 Peter chapter 3. Just to name off the top of my head, there's lots of places that talk about the dynamic of this relationship. So that's also, I think, in 1 Timothy chapter 2. So anyway,
well, Amy. Thank you, Greg. And I actually have a post. I think it's called The Beauty of Submission on our website. Mm. So if you guys are interested in hearing more about my perspective on that, then go ahead and go check that out.
I'm curious. I want to ask you a question more personal to you and your theology.
Okay.
And if because you're single right now, so this isn't something that you face. But if you're a strong reformed person, so if you were – well, this would never happen. But if you were married to an Arminian – or let's say you married a person who's reformed and they changed their mind, okay?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
How would you posture in the same circumstance with children on that issue? What would your answer be precisely the same, or would you modify it a little bit? Or
it's hard for me to imagine marrying someone who wouldn't let me say what I thought about things, but I.
Spoken like a single woman. All right.
I feel like I do pretty well at being respectful of people whose views I disagree with. Mm-hmm. But how would I it's hard for me to imagine, how would I talk about God without that coming into it? It's hard for me to imagine, mm-hmm. because it affects so many different things about all sorts of issues, the problem of evil and salvation and righteousness, like so many different things. There's no way I could keep it out of what I say about mm-hmm. God. I mean, it comes out in the show all the time and all sorts of topics. So I think I wouldn't disparage the other view. And I think I'm pretty good at that, mm-hmm. just because I've had so many opportunities to talk to people who
disagree
right. with me. I just wouldn't disparage it, but I don't know how I could keep it out of what I say. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Okay. Just
so
curious.
It might be difficult.
Put you on the spot in a hard way.
But let's hope that never happens.
Yeah.
Because I can imagine that would be really hard. Mm-hmm. That would be really hard. I mean, what if he stopped being a Christian? Now it's even more difficult to figure out.
Well, this First Peter 3 has some instructions on that. Well, it doesn't address the training of the children issue so much, but mm-hmm. But there's always going to be something. In every single marriage, there is, even the best of marriages, there are differences. And so there has to be, for lack of a better word, a pecking order. And this is what brings order to the home and to the relationships. And when that order is challenged, which it is characteristically in our culture right now, then chaos a kind of chaos results, just like if that was what happened in our Stand to Reason community, you know, our staff community. Well, Greg's not in charge. Well, I don't have to do what he says. I'm doing my own thing. So anyway, I mean, I'm just, as a practical concern, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't want to get too far off the track, but yeah, I definitely go see my post. I just double checked to make sure that was the title. It's called The Beauty of Submission, and I make mm-hmm. an argument for that. Mm-hmm. So, but let's go on to let's get a second question into this show. This one comes from Derek Smith. I asked my daughter, what is the hardest thing about God for her to believe? She said, believing in something she can't see. I'm thinking a mind is a good example to use, but would love your thoughts. I'm pretty sure she's saved, but want her to be convinced in her faith.
Well, this is a very interesting question, and the response is interesting in light of the fact that very early on when I began my learning under J.P. Moreland, he raised this issue regarding his own daughter, who raised the question. And J.P. Moreland, the philosopher at Talbot, and who has been a significant mentor to me over many, many years. And one of his specialties is the mind-body problem. And she raised the issue. And he said, well, honey, you've actually never even seen your mother. And she said, what do you mean? He said, well, because your mother is not just that body that you see. If your mother died, the body would still be there, but your mother wouldn't be there. The thing that is really your mother is not visible. Now, there's a certain sense, and JP would acknowledge this is a bit of an overstatement. It's a hyperbole, because the human being is a union between the physical and the material and the immaterial, okay? The physical and the non-physical. And so when we die, the soul, in a certain sense, is torn, and that from the body, and that union is sundered or split or whatever. And this is an unnatural condition, which is why we have a resurrection where we are restored to the natural condition, and that is in union with our soul and body. So, this would be an interesting thing to use that approach, and I think the way of communicating effectively is this point that I just made. If your mother died, her body would still be there, but you know she would not be there. Okay. So the she that would not be there is not what you see, because what you see is still there. Okay. And this is just meant to vivify or stimulate our natural intuitions about these things. Our natural intuitions are that we are not our ego, our self, the thing about us that is identical with who we are is not physical, because our physical bodies are changing all the time. Okay. So in the same way, and by the way, that's just one example. The idea here is to give her a clear case example that she can relate to of something that is, that she definitely believes in and knows is real, but is not physical. But there are lots of counterexamples of that. Okay. And in fact, we are trafficking in these, watch this word, ideas all the time. The idea. Ideas are not physical. Ideas have propositional content. They don't have physical content. Physical things respond to the laws of physics and chemistry. And but mental things do not, are not subject to those laws in the same way. And so the best way to deal with these kinds of things, people don't believe in God because they don't see him. Well, there are all kinds of things that it turns out they believe in that they don't see. And those, and many of those things, I mean, the daughter probably believes in Paris, though she's never been there. But that is a physical location. Somebody has been there and reported it. So there you've got a testimony that is the evidence of the real thing. But even in that case, it's a physical thing. But there's a whole bunch of things that we are absolutely confident are real but are not physical, okay? I sometimes do this exercise with people, and I have them imagine some state of affairs in their mind, their mother washing dishes or typing or working at the computer or something like that. And I ask them what color blouse that she's wearing, because they close their eyes and they have to imagine this. And then I ask them the question, okay, now you got it. They tell me the color of the blouse. Okay, where was that? Where was that? What they saw so clearly, they could tell the color of the blouse. Where was that image? Obviously, it wasn't mom. It was an image of mom, but where was it? It wasn't in their brain, because if they cracked open their brain, they wouldn't see mom washing dishes with a yellow blouse on. No, it was in someplace else. It was so real, it could be seen. And by the way, this is true of all five senses. You can smell a rose. You can feel fur. You can taste a strawberry. You can hear Beethoven's Fifth. In fact, probably a bunch of people just heard it, dun 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 dun, kind of in their minds, which is the point. Now, these experiences are not as vivid as the actual sensual experience, but they're still real. And what is it, or where are those experiences being had? They are not being had in the brain, and the brain may be involved in them, but they're not. That's not where they're at. And so this little exercise is meant to open up an entire an awareness, a conscious awareness of an entire immaterial world that we are subconsciously or unconsciously aware of constantly. Even when you dream at night, where was all that? Where was that? It's not in your head. There's nothing. There's no dramas unfolding inside of your skull when you're sleeping. These are in an immaterial world, but they are real. And your perception of them demonstrates that they are real, even though they're not physical. Some people say, well, that's not real. That's not reality. Why? Because it's not physical. And notice how they've subtly defined real as physical. But something is real if it's actual, that's all. And if it doesn't have to be physical to be actual. We have tremendous experience with many things that are not. So anyway, that's the way I'd approach that.
I would also say it might help to just – I don't know how old she is, so I don't know how deep to get into things. But God is sympathetic to this view, and we know he is, because what did he do? He worked in history in very dramatic ways to show that he existed. So the whole Exodus happened so that he could – say so that people would know he was God. He works in history. So not being able to see someone physically is not the same thing as that person being absent. And God has worked in history. He has done all sorts of things. So the Exodus might be one place you can take her. But also, what about just looking through, telling her past stories of other Christians' lives and how God worked in those lives? I think seeing God work in history is a way to see that he exists and that he's active and that he's doing things. And we can see that when we look back, and there are all sorts of biographies of Christians who've done all sorts of things. And I think that saturating her with that will be very helpful for seeing him work, because that's what makes God different from all these other gods, mm-hmm. is that he actually worked in history in ways that we can see. And so that might also be helpful, even beyond giving just examples of things that we believe in that mm-hmm. we can't see. Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time, Greg. Mm. All right. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Derek and Alice. And we look forward to getting your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.